Let me welcome you all to Brookings. My name is Tom Lovelace. I'll be moderating the session today. It's on the Common Core standards in education, K through 12 education, and the assessments that will be developed tied to the Common Core. As most of you probably know, the Common Core are the product of two groups, the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers. They worked for over a year to put together, with lots of experts across the country, a set of standards in both reading and mathematics, kindergarten through 12th grade. Those standards were released in June of this year. Last month, in September, the Obama administration awarded grants to two consortia to develop assessments that would be tied to those standards. The panel today will be talking about the potential pitfalls of these standards as we look out into the future, and also their promise as we look out into the future, the challenges that lie ahead and how we may overcome them in implementing these standards and in developing assessments so that we can measure how much kids actually learn in terms of the standards. Let me introduce our panel. Each panelist will be speaking for about 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up to discussion once we've concluded. First of all, clear down the far end, Gregory Sizek is professor of educational measurement and evaluation at the University of North Carolina. Greg's going to be talking about translating standards into assessments, the opportunities and challenges of a Common Core. Next to him is Andrew Porter. Andy is the George and Diane Weiss Professor of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, and he'll be speaking on Common Core standards, the new United States intended curriculum. Then Gary Phillips will be speaking. Gary's sitting next to Andy. Gary is Vice President and Chief Scientist at the American Institutes for Research, and the topic of his talk is International Benchmarking State Education Performance Standards. We're also delighted to have three very important discussants who will be reacting to the papers, talking about how the papers fit into their own understanding of what's going to happen down the line. First, Chris Ellington is Deputy Commissioner, Florida Department of Education. She's the representative of what's known as PARC, one of the two consortia that were funded. That's the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. Joe Willoft, sitting next to Chris, is Assistant Superintendent, Washington State Department of Education. He's the Executive Director of the second consortia that was funded, the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium. And then we'll hear from Roberto Rodriguez. Roberto's sitting here to my right. He's on from the White House Domestic Policy Council, where he's Special Assistant to President Obama for Education. So we're delighted again to have this panel with us. Let me remind you to turn off your cell phones, since I already heard one. I actually have introduced people in this room, and while warning people to turn off their cell phone, had my own cell phone go off. So I know how that can be embarrassing. So let's begin with Greg Sizek.
Excuse me. Good afternoon. Thanks, Tom, for this invitation. It's quite an honor to be here. I'm going to talk quickly. I believe that papers are available also in case someone wants to see more about some of the remarks I've made. For a brief overview of what I hope to do, I want to give some good news and some bad news, a little more bad news as I see it than good news, but with regard to Common Core assessments. I think I'll focus mainly on the concern part of it, things that I think should be addressed with some recommendations for how they might be addressed. Some good news quickly, I think, and these are just sort of high-level things, the good news stuff. I'll get more into the technical things momentarily. But I think one good thing here is that the Common Core assessments will sustain this national focus on educational achievement that we've been experiencing, particularly the focus on college and career readiness. From a psychometric perspective, I think that that construct, career readiness and so forth, is kind of squishy and still ill-defined, but you got to love the concept. So that's a good thing. Next, these are big consortia with a lot of money. So a lot of public attention is going to be focused on educational reform. That's an unqualified good. Next, I waffle about what category to put this in, but standardized assessment. To the extent that the large consortia standardize the educational experiences of students so that students who are mobile across state lines, for example, might have a more common educational experience, it will ratchet up the seamlessness to which people can move about and have lives and children in different states and jurisdictions. So the experience that we saw sort of within states that happened with common curricula under No Child Left Behind, I think, is being extended across states now. And then finally, the fourth good that I wanted to mention was the notion of the computer-based aspect of both of the proposals. Getting the computer more into educational assessment, I think, is desirable from some standpoints, not the least of which is a lot of the security issues that we've been seeing with K-12 assessments. The computer has the potential to address some of those. Some assessment challenges as I see it. First of all, is stability of content standards. Doggone it, I'm not a content specialist. I don't know reading or language arts or mathematics or any of that stuff, but I know people who do. And they love to tinker with the content standards. And tinkering with the content standards, it just makes psychometricians nervous and testing programs go crazy because you don't have a stable scale over time to report student performance on. So I think there's currently, as I read the proposals, little or no information on how they intend to keep the content standards stable enough over time so that you can realize the goal of reporting student performance across jurisdictions longitudinally. Probably a good model for this is the NAEP framework, who I think are pretty careful about the extent to which they allow changes in content frameworks and have about a 10-year or so deadline before new frameworks come out. So stability in content standards, I think, is clearly an assessment challenge. The next thing I want to talk about is performance standards. You can have content standards that are rigorous and desirable and higher and fewer and sweeter and all that kind of stuff. But unless you have performance standards that are equally rigorous, those content standards aren't necessarily very meaningful. So testing specialists would tell you it all comes down to the performance standards. And again, from my reading of the proposals, I don't see a lot in the proposals from either consortium on performance standards. And even specific language that ensures every partner will adopt the same performance standards. There's even some language in there that's a little bit worrisome that says things like, I think this is Smarter Balance that said they're going to have some sort of responsive flexibility or something with regard to the components of the assessment. And I guess it will remain to be seen how flexible that is and how that flexibility plays out in terms of allowing there to be common performance standards. This is kind of a troubling aspect, I think, this notion of inclusion. Whether you liked it or not about NCLB, I think IDEA, IASA, all kinds of legislation over the past couple decades has pressed to include all students in assessments. And we've come to the realization in testing that if you include all students, they end up being pushed instructionally in ways they wouldn't have before. I have a phrase for this that I've tried to copyright. Necessity is the mother of intervention. Which means, if you force people to do it, they'll teach special populations in ways that might not have been otherwise the case. And I think this is another unqualified good. But I'm going to say this, it's probably overstating it, but I have to say I think the current proposals really focus on majority students. There's mentions in there of special needs and ELL and things like that, but the language that's used is, we're going to use universal design and flexibility of computer administration to help these populations. But I'll tell you, about 10 years of experience now with alternate assessments, we've learned two things. It's really expensive, and it's really difficult to do with standard administration practices and without kind of adapting the assessment content and format in ways that make it non-comparable to the assessments used in the general population. So I would say that at some point, there's going to have to be some really hard policy decisions made about whether to, again, develop alternate testing programs that for students who can't be assessed by the main consortium testing program, or to figure out other ways to handle students who aren't well served by the general assessment. You might think this is odd that I have assessment innovation listed as a challenge, but I was kind of impressed with the 50-some little laboratories that existed when state testing programs were doing their own thing and not a part of larger consortia. I thought there were some really good experiments going on out there with computer-based testing, with innovative formats. States were somewhat free to try different things. Now, to be sure, those efforts were slow. They were very buggy. They were hit and miss, smaller testing programs and so forth. But I think they were good laboratory settings for incubating innovations and assessment. I think that's likely to be reduced. I think there's likely to be less impulse to a real innovation once the large assessment program gets in place. The large-scale computer-based is definitely a good idea, but we also have no experience with large-scale every-student computer-based assessment, certainly not in K-12 education. And we're going to have to go from about 0 to 60 in maybe 3 years and buckle your seatbelts, you know. Okay, next, validation. What we have now typically testing folks, I think, would call them standards-referenced assessments. And traditionally, the validation strategies for standards-referenced assessments are pretty straightforward. They rely primarily on alignment studies, on content-based evidence, and so forth. If the Common Core assessments were primarily standards-referenced assessments, then I think the focus on content validation would be pretty routine, and we could just sail right past that. However, I think there's reason to be concerned that a content-referenced validation strategy is not going to be entirely appropriate. Let me give you an example of some of the inferential claims that are made by the proposals. This says the Common Core state standards represent what American students need to know and do to be successful in college and career. The overarching goal of this consortium is to ensure that all students leave high school prepared for post-secondary education or career. This is suggesting a predictive validation strategy. Now, we know how to do that, right? We do that with the SAT and things like that. We do predictive validation in a lot of contexts in psychometrics, but we really don't do that in K-12 achievement testing contexts. So there's going to have to be a shift, either a shift or at least a duality in terms of the validation strategies going on. And as I read the proposals now, there's a lot of heavy emphasis on the content validation strategy, which would be appropriate for a standards reference assessment, but there's virtually no acknowledgement or realization that there's a predictive claim being made here and a predictive validation strategy is going to have to be in place in order for the scores to mean what the consortia intend them to mean and what hopefully the public will interpret them to mean. Number 6 out of 7, accountability. You know, CCA, Common Core Assessments. To be fair, the A is for assessment, not for accountability. But I think I have some concerns here as well. One of the things that has troubled those who have been associated with the National Assessment Governing Board and the NAEP assessments is the lack of student motivation. And it's not clear to me, absent any kind of accountability provisions, how engaged students will be, particularly as you move up the grade levels in terms of their willingness, their alacrity with respect to engaging in the assessments. Now, some of them will be formative and some of them will be authentic and it'll be more engaging and stuff like that. But, you know, high school kids, they can sniff out a test, you know, and they know it's a test. And if it doesn't have accountability consequences or some meaningful attachments to it, then I'm concerned that we might not get in the kind of quality information that we might get otherwise. And I would say to beef up the current proposals, probably some additional emphasis on how the linkages will be made to accountability would be in order. And finally, some of the stuff I said was as a psychometrician. Now, the last point I have is just me ranting. Use of testing to stimulate educational achievement gains. You know, we have tried this like 52 times or more. And I think we've reached the point of diminishing returns on using assessment, formative or summative. I have some hope for the formative aspects of it, but I think we've reached the point of diminishing returns on using testing to stimulate achievement gains. What did NCLB get us in terms of achievement gains? Perhaps most of you here would say kind of modest. Well, why is that? When you push states to adopt common core standards within a state and you have homogeneous tests for all students and stuff, you kind of get moderate content standards and assessments. Now, I would assert that assessment as a reform tool has kind of run its course. As a policy initiative, I call it the quick, cheap, and easy way, because it really is, comparatively, even though my panelists here are sitting on $350 million, it's still relatively quick, cheap, and easy, as opposed to what I would say is the long, expensive, and difficult route, which is long, expensive, and difficult. What would that consist of? The focus of the current efforts, both formative and summative, is this assessment with a promise of utility or actionable information. But I would say what's really needed is not just that kind of actionable information, because we, to some extent, get a lot of actionable information from assessments to date. What we really need is the development of and professional development in research-based approaches for the next steps once you've got the assessment information. Now what do you do? I mean, I think we're swimming in data right now and swimming in information. What we need to know is what are the next steps, and to aid teachers in professional development and other educators in how to incorporate those next steps into their classrooms. I think some of that's going on, but I would say my most dire prediction is this. In order to make the Common Core assessments kind of appear to be effective, in the context of the other stuff that's going on, if we're still making comparisons to NAEP, I'm not sure how long NAEP can hang around. It's of concern to me that NAEP may be threatened by Common Core assessments, and it's probably it's got this name, they call it the Cadillac of testing programs. It really does give good information, but you certainly don't need two large-scale kinds of assessment programs like this. Okay, finally, some conclusions. There's some promising aspects. I glossed over those quickly. I think there's many psychometric challenges. I assert that testing is probably not the best tool for stimulating further achievement gains for students. And finally, I think we need to lower our expectations. I think we should all just, like, back off the expectations here. I'm gonna show you something from, I'm sorry, colleagues, the PARC proposal. You've seen this before? Okay, all right. I don't mean to rub it in. I didn't know you'd seen this before, but they have these, like, through-course assessments, or during the course of the year a student is going to get, I think it says, 1 to 2 constructed response items in grade 3 ELA per quarter. And from this, it says, it will allow monitoring of student progress, support inferences regarding whether a student is on track, inform instructional decisions, signal interventions for students, and permit aggregation to assess teacher effectiveness from 2 to 3 constructive response items. No. I tried to imagine an analogy here. So I'm going to send a proposal into the NIH that says 1 to 2 minutes of light exercise per quarter will lower LDL, elevate mood, prevent aging, boost IQ, reverse hair loss, and increase social desirability. That's equivalent to what's in that proposal. So my conclusion is that we just need to back off some of this euphoria about what this is going to do for us in terms of the assessment information it provides. We just don't have the tools at present to do it. I'm optimistic that some of that money can be spent to develop those tools and to help us push new territory along that route. But we're not there yet. Hopefully we'll get there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you especially for sharing my exercise regimen. Andy Porter.
So the focus of our paper and my comments today is what is this target for these new assessments? What do these Common Core standards represent, and what are the implications of that for testing? But I think the next to the last thing Greg was talking about was a nice segue into this, because ultimately one of the goals is to change and improve what teachers are teaching and what students are experiencing in classrooms. Some people call that the enacted curriculum. And some people talk about these content standards, such as Common Core, as the intended curriculum. That's the title in the title of this talk. And, of course, there is in between the assessed curriculum, and they may be more or less aligned. But for us today, one of the questions is just how much change is implied by these Common Core standards. I want to recognize and thank my co-authors, Jennifer McMakin, June Wong, and Ray Yang, and they're right back there. Hold your hands up, guys. Oh, they're so shy. I also want to thank Rolf Blank at the Council of Chief State School Officers and John Smithson at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, longtime colleagues and collaborators of mine, and the guys that supply me with the data that I need to do the analyses like I'm reporting on today together with my students. And last, and of course, most importantly, thanks to you, Tom, and Brookings to have us here. We were going to do this paper anyway, and out of the blue, we just started talking about it. Tom calls me up, and I say, whoa, okay, great, you know. And of course, there's nothing like a deadline to get you moving along. So this is all good. Now, let's see here. So our question is, how much change in the U.S. curriculum is represented by the Common Core standards in mathematics and English language arts and reading? And we use as procedures something called now the Surveys of Enacted Curriculum, but actually it's a tool that grew out of some research that I and my colleagues were doing back when I was at Michigan State. We were asking, how do teachers make decisions about what to teach, thinking that that was an important part of determining the enacted curriculum, and that probably that was pretty important in terms of determining value added to student achievement. And it ends up now, it's been replicated by several studies, that of all the school control variables, the degree of alignment between what teachers say they're teaching and what's tested is the strongest single predictor of value added to student achievement. It makes a lot of sense. You know, no matter how bad that high school French instruction was, you did learn more French by taking French than if you hadn't done it. But it works on down to a lower level scale as well. Now, what this picture shows is the basic way in which we define content. It's a two-dimensional grid. Now, the topics down the left-hand side, there can be 160, 170 of them. I'm just trying to give you the idea here. And across the top are categories of cognitive demand. It is, you know, so what do you want students to know about a linear equation? You want them to be able to pick it out of a lineup, memorize what it is. Do you want them to be able to fit a line to data? Do you want them to be able to solve a linear equation? Or maybe recognize in a story problem that the solution is to set up a linear equation and solve it. These are the kinds of distinctions. So that for any specific topic going down the left-hand side, you can imagine one or another of several different cognitive demands. I've got five right here. And the same kind of a grid works in English language arts and reading, and it also is available in science as well. So that's the kind of framework for deciding how to describe the content which underlies the intended curriculum, like what's the content in these Common Core standards. And so I give you a little better look at what these cognitive demands are. This is for English language arts and reading, and they differ obviously a little bit in mathematics, but memorize, perform procedures, generate, create, demonstrate, analyze, investigate, and evaluate. By the way, Bloom would have said these are ordered, and if you knew F, you knew B. We don't. We say these are not ordered. You know, you can decide whether you want to believe us or not. But if you take the number of topics by cognitive demand, those form those cells in that two-dimensional matrix, and there are, give or take, about 1,000 of them for any one content. So the distinctions we make in defining content are fairly fine-grained. Now, you can imagine that you have on your one hand Common Core standards and on your other hand maybe the NCTM standards, and you're talking about mathematics. And you could say, all right, in terms of these two matrices of topics by cognitive demand, how similar and how different do they look in terms of content? So how do you do that? You get content experts. I got one over there, Mike. He's worked for me in the past. And they go through and they read these standards and they decide what particular piece of a standard goes in one cell or another, or maybe in several cells. What you get are then proportions, you know, and all across rows and columns, they sum to one. That's all the content you've got. And then you can have, then you can look at whether the content in a standard loads up under linear equations, or under geometry, under algebra, that kind of thing. Now, you can actually calculate, you know, overall, just if these things are perfectly aligned and you looked at these two matrices, the proportions would line up one right on top of another one. So if you just took absolute values of their differences and summed them up, they ought to sum to zero. All I'm saying is that this is you can get you a number that goes from zero to one, perfect alignment down to perfectly lousy alignment, and I'll show you some examples of that. The third comment on methodology is that you can display these results in a variety of ways, and my favorite way is along the lines of a topographical map, and I have one here where the darker colors represent greater emphasis of content, and white represents sea level. So a topographical map, we can think about topics as going from north to south, and cognitive demand is going from east to west. And then we have mountains of emphasis, and we have broad sea levels of no emphasis. So you can see quickly with these pictures what's there but what isn't. And, of course, if you're trying to influence the intended curriculum, a part of the message is, what should I teach? And another part of the message is, what shouldn't I teach? And by the way, in U.S. of A education, it's easier to persuade teachers to teach things they hadn't been teaching than it is to persuade them to quit teaching things that they had. So you got to worry about both sides of the message. There's actually scientific studies on that, guys. Oh, and just, I don't want you to pass out with excitement, but these are brand new results I'm about to present, never seen by man or beast previously. So you are in for an enormous treat. But what I've got here are two of these topographical maps, and you can see to what extent are they similar and to what extent are they different. You know, are the mountains in the same places or not? Now, that's at what we call a coarse grain size, because these topics are number sense, operations, measurement, big chunks of mathematical content, right? Now, we could look at the finer grain, and here we just picked geometric concepts, and we said, okay, if we burrow in on that and we look at finer distinctions, what do we see? And as you might expect, as you go to a finer level of slicing and dicing, you can find differences. Now, one of the tasks that you have to decide is, are the distinctions that we're making important, or are we glossing over important distinctions? You know, what's the right grain size? And you can think about that as we go along, and I'll re-engage you with that at the end of this. Now, I decided that because this is a 10-minute presentation, which I actually hadn't realized until yesterday, that I would skip this table. So this is how you can make progress quickly in a presentation. Not only that, I believe I'm going to skip this table. But it doesn't want to skip it. Okay. Now, one of the questions that people have, and this comes partly came out of Tim's. Remember when Bill Schmidt and company said the American curriculum, the U.S. of A curriculum, was a mile wide and an inch deep, and he likened it to the Missouri River. And he said that was bad. And so we said, well, what's the degree of focus, and how does Common Core compare to state content standards? So we've got a bunch of states, and we had the data on them, and then we analyzed the Common Core using those procedures I showed you. And if you go across the bottom, that's the average number of these topics that are represented grade by grade in the states, and then the NCTM standards where they are present, and then the Common Core. And what you see is, the Common Core is not more focused than the states, generally speaking, although to some extent it is in the lower grades of mathematics. If you think focus is a good thing, the Common Core is probably not taking us there. Now, I'm going to skip this table. I'm going to skip, is this, am I going to skip this table? Yeah. Okay, So now we looked at how content standards align, state content standards align to the Common Core, saying if they're really different, this is a big challenge. At least for teachers, it's going to be a big challenge. Maybe less so for the states, for the tests, because it's easier to make a test than it is to change what teachers are teaching. We also compared them to assessments, and I'm going to go right to that because of short amount of time and because this is about assessments and the implications. So how does state current state tests compare to the Common Core? Now, obviously, they were not built to be aligned with the Common Core. I understand that. But again, if you're thinking about what's in store for you, Joe, then if they're highly aligned, not so much resistance. If they're not very aligned, plenty of resistance. Now, remember that these are alignment indices, and can you tell me what the biggest value these numbers could take? One. And what's the littlest value?
Zero.
And what do you see here? We see they're not terribly aligned. There is some variability, but my golly, for one of those states in grades 6 and 8, their alignment is about as close to zero as you can get. We would say this represents some massive change if indeed Joe builds an assessment which is aligned to the Common Core standards. Now, I have to say that I've got a paper coming out soon which will show you that many of the states which are under law to build assessments that are aligned to their standards don't do a terribly good job of it. So maybe these new state consortium will stay within the U.S. tradition. We're hoping they won't. Now, one of the things you can say is, what if some content is at grade 3 in the Common Core, but in grade 4 in a state standards or in a state's test? Would that be an important difference? And some people might argue it would, and some people might argue it wouldn't. It would be for an assessment developer, because if that's where the teachers are teaching it, then that's probably where we ought to assess it. But in the larger scheme of things, is it important for you to study this in fourth grade or fifth grade? So what we did was we said, what if we just disregard grade level and aggregate across grades 3 through 6 or 3 through 8? And does that improve the alignment? If we don't penalize for distinctions between it just happened to be in fourth grade in one and fifth grade in the other. And you can see the results here. And what you see is that the alignments are a little bit higher. But they're still pretty small. And by the way, you can think about this as basically an alignment number of 0.4 says what proportion of the content in the Common Core standards is also in state tests. That's an easy way to think about it. So now, obviously, if you like numbers, you'll want to pick up a copy of this paper. I have many numbers. But we need to get to the bottom of this. So one thing is, keep in mind, we're talking about the intended curriculum, but what we're really ultimately interested in, I believe, is the enacted curriculum, what teachers and students do together in classrooms. That's a harder scenario to reach, and I think in part what Greg was talking about with the slow and expensive solution. Another thing you need to remember is this. I looked at both assessments and content standards. Content standards are meant to represent domains of content. The whole enchilada. Assessments are supposed to be representative samples of the domain. And in fact, states work very hard to construct forms that are either equivalent or equated over time, but not the same items year in and year out, because they don't want instruction to focus on this sample of items versus that sample of items. So when we look at assessments, you've got to remember the alignment ought to be a little lower because we're looking at the sample and not the domain. But if you study these results, you'll find out that they really aren't that much lower. Is lack of alignment due to content in a standard at one grade level versus another? I already talked to you about that. What is the right grain size for defining content? And here, I have over the years done a lot of thinking about this. Now, if I would have said, are the Common Core standards in mathematics about mathematics, and are state standards in mathematics about mathematics, I would have concluded perfect alignment. They're both about mathematics. But that's a pretty crude level of distinction, you know. I mean, geez, there's a mathematician out there, and he knows that, you know, under that word you can hang a lot of different content. It's possible to know part of it and not others. I mean, people who don't study differential equations usually don't know that stuff too well either. So then if I went down, if you get too fine-grained, then that would be too fine-grained. So what's the right cut through it? I have used as our litmus test the distinctions that are the best predictors of value added to student achievement. I can tell you this. If you do a study and you have teachers describe their content according to this kind of a grid, and then you calculate the alignment between their description and a test you use to do pretest and post-test, that with these kinds of distinctions, you get correlations with those gain scores of about 0.5. And you say, 0.5, that doesn't sound that big. It's only 25% of the variance accounted for. For predicting gain scores, Greg, am I right? That's huge. That's big. That's big. And I'll tell you, all you guys that are fans of teacher pedagogical strategies, they are important, but we've never been able to measure them in a way that they can predict gains in student achievement to that level. So these are big results. However, what if I just collapse my data and say I'm only going to look at topics and not cognitive demand? Those correlations go to zero. Or what if I go the other way and I collapse topics and just look at cognitive demand? Again, they go to zero. So we don't know that we have it at the right level, but it's certainly good enough for government work, and we're here in Washington. Now, what are our conclusions? There are large differences in content messages, that is to say the intended curriculum, between Common Core and grade-by-grade content standards for the same grades. Same thing is true in assessments, and the real point that we have here is about the enacted curriculum. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Andy. Gary Phillips, talk about international benchmarking. And in case you're wondering, it's like a high wire act back here so that we don't fall off the back, if you're wondering why it's taking so long for us to...
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank Russ Whitehurst and Tom Lovelace for inviting me. It's been exciting preparing for this session, and I'm looking forward to it. First, I want to mention that the paper I did is actually a report that came out on Monday, and you should have a copy of that. And I'm going to make just a few references to the findings in that and then transition into what I'm going to talk about today. In this report, what this report does is it internationally benchmarks the performance standards in each state onto the scale of TIMS or PIRLS. And the way this was done was by piggybacking on the most excellent report that NCES did, where they linked the performance standards to NAEP. And so I went the next step and linked it to TIMS and PIRLS. So this gives you then an international benchmark for each state performance standard. When you do that, when you look at performance standards across the states on a common scale, you find the following. These are the main conclusions in the report. There's really only one state that consistently has internationally competitive standards, and that's Massachusetts. The gaps in the state standards, the performance standards, are huge, much larger than I expected. Two standard deviations is the biggest one, which is twice the size of the national black-white achievement gap. It's also comparable to about four grade level differences. So in other words, the states with the lowest standards, let's say in the eighth grade, have standards comparable to the fourth grade in Massachusetts. So the gaps are huge. One reason why this is important is that the performance standards are leading education indicators. When you look at the achievement of a state, that's after everything has been done, like NAEP. When NAEP looks at the achievement, that's after their curriculum is in place, all the teaching has occurred, all the learning has occurred, the testing. That's a kind of a lagging indicator, but the performance standards are what the policymakers expect students to learn. So if you can get a fix on what those are, you know up front what their expectations are. So that's why it's important to try to get a handle on that. The correlation between the percent proficient reported by the states to No Child Left Behind and the difficulty of the standard was almost a perfect negative correlation. It was a negative 0.8 on the average. So there was a huge, obviously, a one way to get, if not the main way, to get high performance under No Child Left Behind is to set low standards. One of the contributors to this, which is going to lead into what I want to talk about today, is there is a section in the report that talks about the way the states set standards in the United States, primarily using like the Angoff method or the bookmark method. There is a problem with that, and what that is that when the standards are set, you develop something called performance level descriptors, which describe, for example, what proficient means. Those are written primarily, normally, by local teachers, local educators, based on local content. There is very rarely any reference to anything external to the state. So the state really has no way of knowing how high a standard should be if they want it to be internationally or nationally competitive. This is a kind of a Lake Wobegon problem where within the state it looks great. A teacher will look at it and say, well, you know, I don't think my students know the Pythagorean theorem in the sixth grade, so I'm not going to set this standard all that high, not realizing that in Finland they know the Pythagorean theorem in the fifth grade. So there is a flaw here, and that's what I want to talk about today, why it is important to internationally benchmark performance standards, not just after the fact like I did in this report, but while you are setting the standard itself. So while you're convening the standard setters and you're setting the standard, you need to know, you should have some external reference as to how high that standard needs to be if you want it to be internationally competitive. There we go. Okay, so what I'm going to do is show you some tables where this was actually done in two states. I'm actually going to, Jan Barth, unfortunately, skip West Virginia because of the time limit and go right to PISA, which I think is what probably most people are interested in. But I do have data here from two states, West Virginia and Hawaii. The international benchmarking with PISA was replicated in 2010 in three states, Hawaii, Oregon, and Delaware, and in three subjects, reading, mathematics, and science. The linking that was done in West Virginia for TIMSS was accomplished by using NAEP, state NAEP, as a crosswalk from the state standard to TIMSS. The linking that was done with PISA was accomplished by embedding secure PISA items into the state assessment through a legally binding agreement that AIR has with the OECD, and then doing the statistical linking through something called common item equating. So what I like to do is, given that, I have a short amount of time, I'm going to skip right to the PISA. There we go. And explain to you how this can be done while you're setting standards on PISA. And what I've recommended in this report, and I'm going to talk about today, is suggesting that standard setting be done in a different way, something which I refer to as the benchmark method, which starts with empirical data to help you decide how high that standard should be. By the way, a discussion of this will be in Greg Sizek's book that will be published early next year. There'll be a chapter in this, and his most excellent standard-setting book, which will be second edition, I think, or so. So
more excellent. We're sitting on $350 million.
So here's an example of how this could be done, and in fact, this was done in the three states that I indicated. On the left-hand side, we have a column of numbers. The way you usually do this, the standard setting, is you take your test. Like in this case, it was grade 10 science, and it was a 65-item test. You take the items, and you order them from easy to hard in something called an ordered item booklet. So 65 at the top is the hardest item on the test, and if you go on down, number 1 is the easiest item on the test. And what you ask the standard setters to do is you take the content standards in the state, you take the test items in the ordered item booklet, and you take the performance level descriptor, and you try to find the item in the ordered item booklet that is associated with the beginning of, let's say, the proficient level. So part of the training is how you do that. And you have maybe 50 to 100 panelists, all of which are doing that, And of course, they don't always agree with each other, so you take the average of their selections. So the way this would work here is, okay, you've got this test, for, in this case was Hawaii, an ordered item booklet based on empirical data. On the next column is the item parameter, in this case from an IRT model. And the third column is something called a theta value, which is associated with each page is a score on the test, which starting out is in what's called the theta metric in IRT, item response theory models. So this third column eventually gets turned into a scale score. But at the time of the standard setting, you usually have this metric. So you have your – so let's say, for example, we're looking at page 43. That would have a scale score associated with 1 in this theta metric and a standard error of measurement of 0.31. Now, the next column, which is column 5, is the what's called impact data. So what you do in a standard setting is when the panelists are setting a standard, and let's say they say, I want to put it on page 43, they want to know, well, how many students in the state will that affect? That would be, in this case, if they put it on page 43, 11% of the students in Hawaii would reach that standard. This obviously is not something normally the panelists like. They say, well, you know, that's not really where we want that standard because of AYP and things like that. So, but this is the kind of thing you do. And this is this generally is all a state has. You have the performance level descriptors. You have the ordered item booklet. You have the state content standards and the impact data. And with that, you set the standards. Now, notice that up to this point, you have no idea how this connects to anything outside of the state. Okay. So what you do here is you do this statistical linking to PISA. And let's say that you were to take a page 43. That is equivalent to a PISA score of 571 after you've done the linking. And that is level 4 on PISA. Level 4 in PISA is kind of like the proficient level. I would say it's like the proficient level in NAEP. Level 3 is kind of like the basic level. And as you can see that in the OECD, which are 30 countries internationally, even though in Hawaii 11% would reach that level, among these 30 countries, 23% would reach that level. And if you were to look at go to Finland, 46%, almost half of the students in Finland would reach that level. And so what you do here is now that you have this information, you now are, before you do the standard setting, you have the state content people create a performance level descriptor based on this statistical linking. So they would take item number 43 to 62, which is about 20 items, to give them an idea of, okay, if I want my state to be internationally competitive based on, let's say, this PISA benchmark, I need a performance level descriptor that describes achievement in the vicinity of a level 4 on PISA. You use those items just like in NAEP where you map to the NAEP scale. Well, this has been mapped. It's mapped to the PISA scale, and you can use those same items to create a performance level descriptor that is now internationally benchmarked so that when you then go to these standard setters, you're going there with a higher level of achievement that's expressed in the performance level descriptor. So the benchmark method needs two things. One is you need to statistically connect your scale in the state to some external scale like PISA, PIRLS, TIMSS, or whatever it might be, and you need a internationally benchmarked performance level descriptor that describes a level of performance that you want your students to reach on the state test that is comparable in difficulty to the standard on the international assessment against which you have benchmarked the state test. When you do this, then I believe what you will find is then rather than basing views about how high the standard should be based on anecdotal local teacher experience, you now have an external referent against which to compare your local experience, and you have a description of the kind of proficiency you want the students to learn in a standard that's internationally benchmarked. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary. We'll now turn to our discussants. First up, Chris Ellington. Again, Chris is representing the Park Consortium.
And the token female. Just some quick takeaways from these three, because I want to talk about what Park's going to do. And as I do that, I'll be touching base with some of what their comments were as well. But I think Greg opened some boxes in the measurement area that I have in my head that I sort of closed and wasn't thinking about because we were working on the larger vision for our assessment consortium, and some of the devil in the details we were putting aside until we got our work underway. So that was painful. Thank you. Andy's comments, I think I sort of juxtaposed those with Gary's because I have trouble reconciling the fact that there's so little in common in content between state standards and state tests with the ability to actually link scales and performance expectations and make some sense of that. So I'm going to touch, I may talk to you later about that and see if we can understand a little bit more. But I do take away a very good thought on standard setting because as we think in our state, because we currently have a new test and we're going to be setting standards in the fall, we've been trying to sort of catch up on what the current methodologies are so that 10 years ago when we set our standards, the profession was in a different place. Where are we now? And Gary has introduced a whole different approach, which I think makes a lot of sense, given the fact that in 14-15, we'll be given a common test that will have some international linkages. So it's nice to have a few years to sort of prepare our public to be ready for those kind of shocking statistics that might come from those comparisons. So thank you for that. So I'm going to move on, and I will just say I found at least one whopper typo in this, and I'm not going to tell you where it is. So that's, we were talking about the Where's Waldo approach to looking at these PowerPoints. This is the map of the park states. We have, in the darker color is the governing states. We have one additional governing state since this was done, and Arkansas just signed on as a governing state for park. Of interest, and I'll refer to this later, is that there are 12 race to the top states that receive state awards. 11 of them are in PARC. Some of them are also in SBAC. But of our governing states, there are 8 that are race to the top states. So we're hoping as we work with our larger consortium, we can pull in some of the state work and actually leverage everything that we're planning to do and bring greater value to the experience. So just some quick facts in case you're not familiar with PARC. Florida is the fiscal agent, and one of the reasons I'm here is because I am from Florida, and I'm the program contact for the grant award. We also have a fiscal contact in Florida. However, we have a governing board that's made up of the chiefs of the 12 governing states, and Mitchell Chester from Massachusetts is the current chair of PARC's governing board. ACHIEVE is our project management partner. Some of you may be familiar with ACHIEVE and their work with the American Diploma Project. Mike Cohen is the president. Laura Slover, who was actively involved in the Common Core Standards, will be the PARC director. She's also a vice president with ACHIEVE. So the funds from this award, again, in case you're not familiar, will fund the research, design, development, and field testing, however, not the operational administration, which will take place in 2014-15. But these awards are not just about assessment. They're also about getting ready to enter into these assessments, and that means a lot of research, but it also means some strategy on how to get there and how to get ready. As part of PARC's work, and I think we'll be working with Smarter Balanced on some of this, we're going to be developing a sort of a digital resource library that provides tools and resources for teachers, both for Common Core standards and what that will look like in our assessments, and a lot of transition support. In fact, both consortia recently were awarded some supplemental funds that we didn't ask for, which is kind of interesting, to help states transition and get ready to implement the Common Core, make sure it's happening right down to the classroom level, and provide some support for states to get there. So the total funding with, for PARC with this supplemental award is approximately $186 million for the what's not quite 4 years of the award. So our fundamental goal, our real imperative in this, is that the states in our partnership are truly committed to working together to build our capacity to increase the rates at which our students graduate from high school prepared for college and the workplace. We're also committed to doing some research on key innovations. We know we've got a bold proposal, and Greg pointed out some of the issues that we have in front of us, but we really do believe that a lot of this is possible, that we are aiming high and we have lofty goals, and we're going to use a procurement process that allows us to identify the best in class, both in public, private, and philanthropic partners to help us accomplish this. Florida has a process called ITN, Invitation to Negotiate, and it's one that allows us to establish a contract after going through somewhat of a brainstorming process with our vendors. So we do intend to work very hard to ensure that we've got the best people at the table, and I think this is an opportunity for us to take assessment and all that's associated with it to a new level. So our theory of action, just briefly, more meaningful standards. I think Andy's research has really pointed out to us what a heavy lift this is going to be. This was very revealing to me, very interesting information, because I didn't realize how little in common we had, both with a common core but across states as well. So if we think about touching every classroom and have them ready in 2014-15 to take the same test when we are so different right now, what a long way we have to go. High-quality test, and these tests, including the through-course assessments that are in PARC, are intended to signal high-quality instruction. So it's not just about the bubbles now. It's about having meaningful work that also provides valid and reliable, technically defensible information that can be used for a variety of purposes. Maximize technology. There are a lot of states in PARC who aren't ready for computer-based testing, but they have bought into this because they understand that if we're not ready by 2014-15 to deliver and test our standards using technology, then we are really in the wrong business for our students. It's time to get there, and the whole community needs to work shoulder to shoulder to get us there. So there is a very large effort within states to push technology, and we're hoping that the U.S. Department of Education is also listening and is going to help us get there. Cross-state comparability. In terms of the value of this has already been mentioned. We think of a passport as students are transferring across state lines, that they have ability to take their educational information with them in a way that's transportable and comparable. I think in terms of the international benchmarking issue, some of this research indicates that Massachusetts has higher standards than the international standard for proficiency. And I think that one of the benefits and the challenges that we have in PARC is that Massachusetts is in our consortium. And so we really don't need to do international benchmarking because we have Massachusetts. And Massachusetts is not going to lower their standards, let me tell you, if you've been paying attention to the press. They're not going backwards. So all of us are going to have to reach to where Massachusetts is. And we're very much aware of it and scared to death. So... intended outcomes, report achievement results, and a clearly defined path towards readiness for college and career that's on track, not necessarily college ready in third grade. Compare results against a common high standard. Accountability is very important in PARC. Some of you know Florida has actually seen where assessment can drive improvement, especially in subgroups of populations. Not assessment alone, lots of support and resources and tools for teachers and rewards, but also sanctions for not doing well. And I think our subgroup closing the gap efforts are good testimony that those types of pressures can make a difference. The theory of action for our stakeholders that will have a variety of good information that helps inform programs and practices, that higher education is an important partner with us, as I mentioned, Achieve as our project management partner, and their work on the American Diploma Project has a big outreach effort all the time with the post-secondary community, and we had lots higher engagement from higher education in the proposal project process as well as post-award. So we already have a higher ed council, and we have contacts in every state. And it's our intent that they're going to be partners from day one, so that as we design and build our assessments and get to the point of setting standards, that they're invested in what we do and they believe in it because they've been part of the process. And for some states, that's a lot harder job than for others. I'm going to skip over quickly to the assessment design. You'll see it as a distributed summative. So as we have assessments throughout the year that are robust performance tasks, robust, really big, not narrowly defined, not short, that need to be, in most instances, hand-scored, but hopefully lots of artificial intelligence scoring as well, doing some rate of reliability comparisons between the AI scoring and the human scoring and improving that process as well. One of the ways that Smarter Balanced and PARC intend to work together is supporting some research in artificial intelligence scoring because we both need it, and we need it in 4 years. So as you look through the year, the approximately quarter checkpoints where through course assessments are being given for ELA and math and all of the grades, one of the things this implies is somewhat of a scope and sequence or an aligned curriculum. And when you look at 26 states where we have a variety of local control versus non-local control strengths, this is a challenge. And so we are considering the implications of this. We definitely will have model curriculum frameworks, maybe even more detailed than that in terms of scope and sequences. But we're also going to look at a modular approach and how we can give flexibility where it can be given, but also keep things standardized to the point where we can make the comparisons that we intend to make and need to make. The end of year test is designed to be quickly scored, computer delivered, but we're going to push the boundaries of what the field can give us in terms of innovative item types that can be machine scored, but are open-ended and give us more information about what students know and can do. Because this is the test at the end of the year that needs to be turned around quickly for use in high-stakes accountability decisions, including in many of the PARC states' teacher effectiveness ratings. So here's the big push from a measurement perspective, or one of them, is that these through-course assessments together with the end-of-year assessment are intended to be combined into a summative score. So if you're in the measurement field, we need your help because they also need to be cross years, comparable, reliable, valid. We're also working on a lot of formative tools and supports for teachers. There's a digital resource library that, again, I mentioned we're going to try to work together to the greatest extent possible with Smarter Balanced. We intend to release a large percent of our items, including sample student work and scoring rubrics. From an adaptive perspective, this is as far as we're going right now, and that is that text complexity diagnostic tool as a way to make sure at the beginning of the year that teachers know the level at which their students are reading and can select the appropriate scaffolding of text to get them to where they need to be by the beginning and the end of the year. We also have funds to build K-2 assessments that are formative in nature for English, language arts, and math, but so do a lot of the states that are Race to the Top awardees. So this is where we'll be looking at ways to sort of build out a larger system possibly than the original award because of leveraging the dollars that each of our Race to the Top states have. A key partner, as I mentioned again, is our higher ed folks, and they will be guiding our strategy to engage all colleges and universities through our Higher Ed Council. And we're looking at ways that we can take the information that we get from, in particular from our high school assessments to help to smooth the transition between high school and college and avoid the high numbers of students who need remediation and likely don't finish because of that when they get to colleges. So we're talking about bridge courses and other types of early warning signals for students in high school so that they can be prepared to be successful when they enter college. We have really thought about standard setting, and we've also thought about the college career ready predictive and concurrent validity studies. So this is our right now just a little bit of the lens on how we're going to look at it, making sure that our claims of college and career ready are substantiated through both by design through judgment and such as that with our higher ed partners, but also after the fact and looking at the success of those standards. I already talked about that. Timeline, so ambitious. And working with just our 12 governing states, trying to move things forward, we got the notification in September, and it's the end of October, almost November, and we're still dealing with some very basic kinds of things that prevent us from taking huge leaps, like getting our procurement documents pulled together and out there. But we're working hard to move it as quickly as possible because we have an ambitious timeline. One of the reasons it's so ambitious is we want to do 2 years of field testing because we're going to try to set at least preliminary standards in the summer of 2014 prior to the first full administration. And we know that students aren't fully motivated when they take field tests, so the quality of the statistics that we would use in standard setting post-field testing is not going to be as strong as if we waited until after the full operational administration when they will be motivated. So this is really ambitious. One of the benefits of the type of award that we have with the U.S. Department of Ed is that it is a cooperative agreement, in part because the SEA reauthorization hasn't occurred and things may change under that light. But they also recognize that we have taken on a very ambitious goal, and they're prepared to work with us as we go through the next 4 years and make adjustments as we have to. So it's an exciting time, and it's a challenging time, and we are very optimistic and pay attention. Okay. Did you find the typo yet?
Thank you, Chris. Joe? Joe Wilhoff from the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium.
I'm on belay. I'm ready to fall off the cliff here. Okay, everybody presumably has the set of handouts, and so there will be some slides that I'll pass over following the Dr. Porter procedure to make sure that we have adequate time to provide discussion of the papers. Want to thank Brookings for bringing us all together. This is the first time that Chris and I have had the opportunity to share a podium and kind of collaborate, and we're nudging each other while the papers are going on and so forth and so on, making plans already. So these are the states that are in the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium. The fuchsia-ish states are the governing states, and the blue-ish Seattle Mariner teal-like states are what we refer to as our advisory states. And together, between the two consortia, 44 states plus the District of Columbia are engaged in one consortium or the other, or in some instances, both. So we have a lot of the nation engaged in this activity. A little bit of history. This started off with Oregon and Washington and Idaho and Utah getting together, trying to figure out how white might we do sort of the Reese's peanut butter thing of getting the adaptive testing and performance tasks happening at the same time. And so we started thinking about summative assessments that would be adaptive with performance tasks. At a similar time frame, we had a group called Mosaic working out of the Midwest, Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, Wisconsin, thinking about expanding formative opportunities with comprehensive assessment programs. Pretty early on, we joined hands and that became the Smarter Assessment Consortium. And then some of the New England states and West Virginia were working to develop something they refer to as a balanced assessment consortium that would include a lot more expansive performance tasks that might take place over several days and so forth and so on, and integrating that with a summative assessment. And so we got together and formed one entire consortium and put together the proposal for the department. That proposal, by the way, was announced in a notification inviting applications, I think, around April 6th. So between April 6th and June 23rd, when they were due, these two groups had to coalesce, in our instance, 31 states, and in Park's instance, what, 26 states or something like that. So it was a whirlwind activity. And some of the concerns raised in Greg's paper, I think, are very valid. Looking at the application form of what the application required from the department in concert with the proposals of what we proposed, I think can shed some light on where some of these gaps are, because actually some of Greg's outstanding observations actually weren't part of what we had to respond to in the application. So it's sort of work moving forward. So it's looking at those two married. You can see the names of the states here. We are governed through a governing committee that has two co-leads, Tony Alpert and Judy Park from Oregon and Utah, respectively, a governing committee that you can see in your handout. And with regard to overall management, beginning November 15th, I'll be the executive director for the consortiums. I'm leaving my position in Washington State to take that on. And our management partner is WestEd in a parallel role to Achieve has with Park. And then Sue Gendron and Linda Darling-Hammond have been helping us a lot with regard to both policy issues and pedagogy and design issues. So how do we get from this Common Core standards that are supposed to specify expectations for college and career readiness and make the leap over to all students can leave high school college and career ready? So this kind of gets to Andy's paper about how do we align this whole system together. And our theory of action really has three steps to it. The first are adaptive summative assessments, and they're benchmarked to college and career readiness. Greg's paper, he didn't mention it much in his comments, but his paper made the point that these assessments are truly not standards-based assessments. They're, and then he mentioned in his presentation about the notion of being criterion-based. And so this, the standard setting on this, and thank you, Gary, for having us think internationally, is an interesting challenge, isn't it? Because really this, and the department said in their announcement, and we said in our proposals, that this is benchmarked to students who meet these standards in high school can enter credit-bearing college courses without remediation. And so that's a pretty clear standard. But how? Where are the data systems that allow us to build that, and then how do we link that back to 8th grade, 7th grade, 6th grade, back down to 3rd grade is a stair-stepping challenge that I'm not sure 48 months is enough time to get all that work done. But we certainly have a challenge there. These adaptive assessments will use computer adaptive technology so that we get good and accurate measurement across a broad spectrum of student achievement and can do that with a shorter end-of-year test. That's going to be important. The accuracy across a broad range of students is going to be important if we want to get accurate kinds of growth measures. So we'll use the adaptive technology in our performance tasks to present students with performance tasks that are tailored to where they are performing on the assessment. Again, assessing the full range using a variety of item types with achievement and growth measures. And it will allow for state-to-state comparability. One of the nudges that Chris and I were having during the conversation, and actually before we met, were there's a lot of these collaborative efforts that the two consortia really sensibly should resolve together. Accommodations for students with special needs. There's no sense for there to be two solutions to that. Chris mentioned AI scoring. And the comparability of the cut scores is another place where we're going to need to collaborate so that parents in Florida and parents in Washington would know where their students stand regardless of which of the two assessments they took. I think the department was wise in funding two of these efforts because if there were only one and it failed, you wouldn't know if it was the effort or the solution. And if there's two and it fails, we get a pretty good evidence that this was a bad idea. But, you know, Greg mentioned this notion of the 50 little experiments going on. And if you're inside a state, it does not feel like an experiment. It feels like you have one solution that the peer reviewers will allow you to have, and you're really constrained to that one solution. Looking, it's kind of a balkanization of assessment situations. And I think there's great promise with these two consortia of having sort of this, you know, cooperative competitiveness across the two of them, I think, will be beneficial. Boy, what's my time system? Time is a wasting while she looks it up. 3 minutes. Okay, I'm going to fly through the rest of this now. There's a second leg of this stool, which are interim assessments. Park will have their through-course assessments that roll up to a summative score. The Smarter Balance solution is to have open interim assessments that teachers can see. They will be linked to the same scale as the summative assessment at the end of the year, but teachers will be able to use them to adjust their instruction and kind of see how students are doing as they move through the school year. Also, what particular standards are assessed at a particular time will be menu-driven so that different localities can adjust their scope and sequence within the school year. I'll skip by all of these animations and go to the third leg of the stool, which is access to formative strategies and tools. Chris mentioned the sort of digital library. We're going to have a similar plan. There will probably be some of that that we'll collaborate on and some of that we'll have uniquely. And, of course, it will all be supported by a technology backbone that will support the adaptive testing engine, the student record maintenance system, and the dialoguing social networking across of teachers across schools and even across states. And again, I'll skip through these. These are all linked together. Those red arrows indicate that it's all one system. Reviewing my notes from this. You know, Gary's point about standard setting at the international level, we get TIMS results about 2 years after TIMS was given, so it's not really a responsive assessment system. And NAEP is about 6 months later after those assessments are given. We're talking about something that's on the order of weeks after the assessments are given. And in our instance, the interim assessments would be really essentially real time as the students take the assessments. So there's kind of these broadening circles of linkages between how far they get away from the student, and they do probably need to be coherent in the sense that they are linked and they make sense with regard to their connections with one another. Clearly, the utility of the TIMS and PISA and NAEP information for the individual classroom teacher about what do I do tomorrow is relatively limited, but we want to make sure that the assessment information we put in front of the teacher regarding what they need to do tomorrow is somehow associated with those NAEP and TIMS and PISA standards so that we're giving them reasonable advice. Greg had a copyrighted statement, I think it was Greg, and I have a copyrighted statement as well, which is that for so long we've heard about data-based decision-making, and I think we have that exactly backwards. I think what we should be doing is having decision-based data-making. In other words, we should be making the data and shaping the data in a way that helps folks make the decisions rather than just putting the data out there and assuming that people make the right decisions. It's sort of like when you give someone a hammer, everything is a nail, kind of a metaphor. And what we should do is make sure that the hammer is precisely designed so that it's aimed at the right kinds of nails. I think I'm probably out of time, okay, sadly. So if you want to learn more about Smarter, our website is there, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Roberta Rodriguez now will talk. Roberta's from the White House Domestic Policy Council.
Thank you. I'm going to speak here from the table. I want to begin by just thanking Tom and Russ for facilitating this really important conversation, and it's a real honor to be here and to join the esteemed panel today. I'd like to step back a moment and maybe reflect a bit on the imperative behind common college and career-ready standards and the assessment work that we're hearing about today, and maybe discuss a bit our the thinking behind our administration's strong focus in this area. Clearly, as we know, standards and assessments have really been the building blocks that have driven standards-based reform in the states and at the local level for several decades now, for a few decades now. We really bring an important imperative to this work in terms of the importance of raising those standards to deliver a rigorous and relevant level of instruction that will prepare all of our students to really succeed in a new economy and with new skills. I think Andy very well painted the significance in terms of the departure that college and career-ready standards in the Common Core signifies for the existing state of education in terms of really raising the bar and the rigorous and the rigor of current standards. We are clearly looking at a level of assessment and a level of instruction that will be much higher than we see in many of our states. And certainly, I think the work around framing new college and career-ready standards as well as better assessments to match those standards is not the only key to reform, but certainly we believe it is a key element of a reform plan. We have a reform plan our administration has laid out for K-12 education to really meet the president's goal of, again, leading the world with the highest proportion of college graduates by the end of the next decade. That includes a transformation of how we think about the teaching profession, how we develop, evaluate, support, and advance our teachers. We have a reform plan that includes looking at data-driven decision-making and standing up the types of systems we need to use data better at the state level, at the local level, at the school level. We have, obviously, plans to really transform some of our persistently low-performing schools that for too long haven't measured up in terms of performance. But all of those things, I think, are really dependent on doing a better job in raising the rigor of our existing standards and really developing new assessments that really measure up to those standards. There are, I think, in the current environment, a few things that are really critically important that No Child Left Behind brought us with respect to this work. Clearly, it brought us a greater focus on looking at measuring achievement, student achievement, in a comparable manner in grades 3 through 8, moving that from 15 states at the time that No Child was debated to the point at which it passed to all 50 states in grades 3 through 8. It brought us a focus on all students being included in those assessments, and it really brought us a new accountability framework at the federal level that was really driven by proficiency and the notion of proficiency for all students in reading and math across the country. It did leave us, however, with some challenges. We were left with the challenge in particular of rigor that we've heard a lot about in today's conversation, and the fact that even looking at the NAEP data, we were seeing two states call eighth grade proficiency something that's 78 points of achievement that there's a gap of 78 points. You know, we're looking at multiple levels, and now as we look at the PISA and the new analysis with the TIMSS, we're looking at multiple levels of learning and achievement that are separating subject matter mastery from one state to another. That's a key challenge that we have to really address if we're going to move standards-based reform forward. We saw that we still had one snapshot in large part for student learning. In many states, the development of new 3-8 assessments under the No Child regime really meant that these were still largely very quick, one snapshot captures of student achievement in reading and in math. We also saw, I think, a lack of utility or relevance of some of the assessment results at the local level. The assessment regime under No Child clearly is a very useful regime for accountability decision-making, for driving pieces like AYP, but we need to also make sure that the practice of assessment more broadly can be useful for teaching and learning at the local level for educational decision-making. And I think as we heard today, more discussion, we saw, unfortunately, in many states, a set of incentives at the federal level that really, in some places, caused a race to the bottom or a lowering of state standards, which clearly is not going to help us move forward with respect to our international competitiveness. So we really view the idea of a Common Core in college and career-ready standards as an opportunity here to really have one roadmap that's a rigorous roadmap for to help guide teaching and learning at the local level, and really an opportunity to raise the bar, as the president says, to move us from the middle to the top of the pack in subjects like math, and to do a better job of really expecting more and beginning by being clear about what we think our students need to know and be able to do to succeed in a global marketplace. I'd argue that the idea of a common comparable set of college and career ready standards also provides us an opportunity to innovate. I know there are certainly challenges around innovation with respect to a standardized set of expectations, but at the same time, I think it also offers an opportunity to really infuse a level of consistency across the system with respect to teaching and learning and with respect to achievement, that then underneath which there can be a lot of innovation around both how to measure that that attainment, as well as how to really revise teaching and instructional strategies to get there. I think there were a number of great challenges that I think were highlighted in some of the work that Greg presented around the movement forward with respect to the current two assessment grantees. I just want to begin there by saying that we're really encouraged by Park and Smarter and very excited about the notion of having in 4 years a really visionary new generation of assessments across 44 states that really can drive college and career readiness for all of our students. We do believe there are some issues that we need to continue working on. I think probably the idea of looking at how we include all students is clearly continues to be a challenge, and I think it's important to really double down on that work, because our federal framework under the current ESEA, as well as our revisioned ESEA, our re-envisioned ESEA, really stands to drive a higher level of teaching and learning for all students, including our students with disabilities and our English learners and our other students with special needs. I think there also are obviously challenges with respect to the stability around content, and probably one of the largest pieces of work that has yet to be accomplished around establishing a comparable level of performance in the performance work and standards there. So certainly those are pieces that I think we'll need more of a focus on and we'll need more work on moving forward. But I do think that there are clear benefits that we will see come out of these two new projects over the next 4 years. I think you've heard certainly both projects reflect a focus on interim or through course assessments as a key design element that will really help us, I think, move away from one-time snapshot end of the year look at student achievement, and will help us better use ongoing information about how students are doing, how they're progressing, how they're learning, to really inform instruction. And in many respects, we'll do that in real time for a number of educators. So I think that's tremendously powerful. I think the idea of having formative elements really integrated into a comprehensive assessment system provides a real opportunity to enable our teachers to more quickly and effectively respond to the instructional needs of their kids. We are, I think, both projects envision a level of performance tasks and items that I think also will provide a richer picture of how students are progressing and learning, and will provide an opportunity to measure complex skills that are really needed for the 21st century workforce in the frames of reading and in the frames of math, and that's also a real benefit. Both also, as you heard, really envision innovative use of technology as part of the assessment design. And again, I think that we know a whole lot more today than we did as standards-based assessments were beginning to ramp up throughout the states 10 years ago across all subject, across 3 through 8 in reading and in math. And that gives us an opportunity, I think, to really think about new modes of delivery and more innovative use of technology to deliver a richer item bank and a richer task. And then I think finally we'll see hopefully a common set of work across both consortia. I think you've heard a good deal of expression around collaboration to really address some of these challenges. So I think moving forward, we obviously have some challenges in a broader federal framework to bring these new college and career-ready assessments to scale in a new federal law and in a new federal framework. And we've been very focused as an administration on the redesign of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act to really think about building a system of college and career readiness within which these new assessments and these new standards might sit. Certainly that requires really taking a closer look at how we support teaching and learning, at how we support professional development and teacher preparation and advancement across our federal system, aligned to college and career readiness. It also really involves bringing online a new set of instructional materials and a new set of research-based teaching techniques, as well as materials and curricula to that are really aligned to college and career readiness. So those are really some of the taller challenges, but also some of the pieces that we've really envisioned as we're thinking through a reauthorization of ESEA and proposing a new framework there. And there obviously is why, where we're proposing new investments in reframing teaching and learning in reading, new investments in reframing teaching and learning in the STEM areas, in science and technology, engineering and math, new investments in really re-envisioning how we prepare, recruit, and develop our educators, and also ongoing investments in assessment, not only to help ensure that the work that's underway with this $350 million investment is successful, but also importantly to help our states stand up and fully implement a new higher quality level of assessment for our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Roberto. And thank you to all the panelists for really illuminating for us here today, the aspirations of this program, but also many of the challenges. So with that, let me open the floor up now to questions from you. We have people with microphones somewhere, I think. Yes. And if you'd identify yourself, please, when you pose your question, that'd be appreciated. So we'll start here on the aisle.
Thank you. My name is Eileen Ahern. I work for the National Association of State Directors of Special Education. And actually, we have four consortia developing assessments that are aligned to or connected with, or however, whatever verb you want to use, the Common Core standards. And it's really important I think everyone involved or interested in this process to understand the challenges that that poses for assessment. Two grants have been awarded for two other consortia to develop an assessment for the most significantly cognitively disabled children. And in developing them, one of the requirements is that they coordinate their work with those consortia that are developing the general ed assessment. So I guess my question to you is, the alternate assessment that they are developing will cover maybe 1% of the population maximum. So the rest of the students, all of the rest of the students, are in the general assessment. Can you address any issues that have been discussed or planned around looking at computer-adapted items on a test and the approach to including all students, including all the other students with disabilities?
Yes, thank you for... thank you. Thank you for bringing up and reminding us about the other two consortia that are out there. And those two consortia include states that are in both of our consortia. So there's quite a bit of kind of cross-fertilization going on there. And issues and problems will be addressed and solved in those two 1% tests that will have bearing on both of the consortia. Also, another interesting feature is that the two 1% consortia grants are supposed to have assessments ready for implementation a year earlier than both PARC and SMARTER need to have their assessments ready for implementation. So the questions and issues around standard setting and alignment will certainly be interesting to resolve. The notice inviting applications that the department released made it very clear that these new assessments that both PARC and SMARTER were funded for need to be designed so that they can assess all students except for the students with the most severe cognitive disabilities. And so we had to develop and were compelled to develop designs for all students including all students with disabilities across, except for the 1% youngsters, all students who are among our most able students as well, our English language learners and so forth and so on. So this does represent a formidable challenge for us to do. We think the adaptive system actually can lend some support in this area, particularly less so across the language barrier issue, but across the different levels of achievement performance because of the ways in which it can move the test itself to the place where the student is performing. A issue that is yet to be really fully fleshed out is the extent to which this represents the assessment going across grade levels and into standards that are actually targeted in another grade. If that's the focus of your question, I think I have to at this point answer, I don't know, quite frankly, because as you do know, the NCLB up to this point has been very clear that it is about assessing the grade level standards and where students sit against their grade level standards. And so that's a question we have yet to unravel with the department. And my hunch is it awaits ESEA conversations with regard to how the Congress views that as well.
May I just make a quick comment on that same topic? Let me just say I think that with respect to assessing these both students with disabilities and English learners, there's perhaps those two populations, I think, stand to benefit the most from having a set of high-quality common assessments, because the variability around the existing testing practices in the states with these populations is probably greater than any other. I think sitting in two new consortia that really are speaking a common language around accommodations and around inclusion, and sitting in a new framework, federal framework, of a full growth model in terms of accountability, I think could be a real benefit for students with disabilities.
Okay, another question right here.
Reggie Felton, National School Boards Association. There's been a lot of talk about the challenges facing the development of these assessments, but if we look at the movement toward high-stakes exit exams and the cultural shifts that had to take place in those schools, I'd like to know who will be addressing the tremendous cultural changes that will be going on in these states and in these districts in preparing, because come 4 years, obviously we don't just turn off one faucet and turn on another. So is anyone addressing that transition and the kinds of challenges that states and local school districts will be facing as they transition?
That's an excellent question. I think that was one of the reasons that the U.S. Department of Ed made these supplemental awards to our consortia, because this is 4 years is really not a long time to be ready for the kinds of change we're talking about. So as we're working, because we didn't have detailed fleshed out plans for this transition support, but now that the supplemental award has been made, we are having very deep conversations about that and what it will take. So some of what our consortium has been talking about as we design our plan for helping the transition and implementation of both the Common Core standards and the associated assessments, we've been talking about what we can do. Now, you know, obviously every state has a role in this, and the consortia can't do it all. So the states are definitely very much aware of this. We just had a recent governing board conference call with the commissioners in our states, and this is very high on their list of concerns and priorities. And they know the states that have state race to the top awards have some advantage because they have additional resources, supplemental resources at their hands to help them. So in PARC, at least, we've looked at the supplemental award plus the states that have state race to the top awards, and we're talking about ways that we can leverage all of those dollars to provide supports, both in terms of communication, strategies for implementation, teams that would come into a state that to support state-level teams, that would be strategizing and developing and implementing resources to help build understanding of the Common Core standards. I think one of the advantages, even though this is a short period of time, is that the states collectively, the 44 at least, and all those that adopted the Common Core, have a similar goal. So it's not 50 states plus D.C. working independently, doing things, you know, scattershot. We're all focused on similar needs and challenges. So while I can't give you specifics yet, when we have our plan to the U.S. Department of Ed, there will be specifics in it. And we hope that your folks are good partners within each state as we work to accomplish these purposes.
Okay, over here. Purple shirt.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. I'm just retired. My
Show
question
up.
Is about something Gary Phillips said, that the core standards are not really well focused. And one of the determinants of how successful education is that there is focus. So how much of a problem is that going to be for the core standards and its assessment?
This question of focus is a tough one. it involves making some decisions, people in the United States, anyway, they don't like to rule things out. They like to, you know. In fact, I remember a long time ago, I gave a talk at an organization called the Society of Scientific Society Presidents, and it was a small group. But it was right after the science standards come out, and all those guys were saying, "Hey, my science isn't in here." And so there is this general tendency to want to be inclusive. And, you know, what if we get it wrong? What if we have a focus and it's on the wrong thing? I'm not sure what that would be and how we would know, but it is a worry. And, in fact, when you talk to some people, not in the education circles, but like, you know, when I was at Wisconsin, I was talking to people on the scientists there, you know, they say, you know, I don't know whether I like this idea of focus common standards, because I just think we could get it wrong, and how would we know? So I think there will be great resistance to focus. I think that's expressed in the Common Core standards and their lack of focus, despite the fact people say we need it. I don't think we're going to have it.
Yeah, I might just add that issue of focus relates, I think, to the school board's person's question as well, because everybody in this room probably knows this, but there will be students who will be subject to their current state testing programs, and who would have an expectation that their diploma would be, or status, or any other kind of thing associated with that in terms of a consequence related to that curriculum, related to that accountability system that's in place under that. So how will a state keep – I mean, I hope the federal government – I'm ambivalent about this, whether the faucet needs to remain open and just keep flowing out money, because it will have to sustain states. It will need to keep those state-level testing programs in there to serve students who are under state-level kinds of testing programs. At the same time, they're beginning to implement the consortia-based testing programs.
If I could add one comment dealing with focus, and that's with high school mathematics. In the Common Core, they're called two pathways through high school mathematics. One, it would be through integrated mathematics courses offered in grades 9, 10, 11, and 12. And for those, a year-end or end-of-year assessment seems appropriate. However, the other pathway, which is far more common in the United States, in fact, more than 95% of students go through this pathway, is through courses. So in algebra, geometry, algebra 2, trig, calculus progression. Now, this really has an effect on assessments. Are we going to be testing, and I'll ask the two consortia representatives, are you going to develop tests that test end-of-year 10th grade math, end-of-year 11th grade math, end-of-year 12th grade math, or are you going to develop assessments that test knowledge of geometry, algebra, trigonometry, and calculus, or are you going to do both?
One of the toughest conversations we've had, out of many, by the way. We went into the proposal development phase keeping the doors open to both approaches, even talking about the notion of modules of math content that could be rearranged, you know, sort of a Chinese menu approach, which presents measurement challenges. We are probably in our consortia right now, we're more leaning towards end-of-course exams for the traditional mathematics courses. But we really haven't closed the door on the notion of trying to serve both masters. So it's a near-term decision that has to be made, because we certainly at least have to have some glimmer of what we're going to do before we write our procurement documents.
So the... And we faced the same issue when we had our last sort of planning meeting of all 31 states and who's going to write which portions of the proposal, and you know, came to a dead stop when it came to the question of, well, is the high school test going to be end of course based, or is it going to be comprehensive based? In the final analysis, we decided for the proposal that we would be comprehensive based, because it would be more difficult for non-end-of-course states to make that transition to an end-of-course environment than it would be the other way around. But we also know that we need to somehow accommodate the end-of-course situation. I actually work in a state that is developing end-of-course assessments for both course of studies, both the traditional course of study and the integrated course of study, and that's not a pleasant test design challenge to face. And so as a consortium at this point in time, and as with PARC, we're still working with our states to figure out exactly what the plan is, but we're thinking of the interim assessments for grades 9 and 10 could be course-based as an option for states to build their own test with clusters of items around clusters of standards, but like the interim assessments in 3 through 8, they would not be part of the accountability use, but would be really for more interim purposes, maintaining the end of 11th grade test that would be required for all students.
Okay, a question back here in the back, and then I'll come up here.
I'm Barb Kapanis, and I'm from the National Education Association. And we're hearing from teachers that one of the major concerns in all of this is they're excited about the Common Core standards and trying to implement them. They're ready to go. And yet they're in states where they're being told they have to prepare their kids for the old state assessment. And this kind of, I call it the time warp, because people are stuck in this situation of having to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind with assessments that nobody likes very much anymore. We're beginning to see their limitations. People are anxious to get off and going, but we're not going to have these new pieces for a while. So what do we do in the meantime? Do we just try to make our teachers deal with, you know, trying to go in two directions at once? And I guess maybe this is directed particularly at you, Roberto, because is there any hope that we'll get some policy at a federal level that will support the transition rather than making everybody schizophrenic?
It's that million-dollar question, transition. It's
more than $1 million.
Yeah,
actually.
More than $1 million. It's true. It's really important. It is our hope to really advance an agenda and a re-envisioning of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, working with Congress, that will enable us to have a smooth transition into a new federal framework that reflects college and career readiness, and that is state-led around the standards and assessments. But, you know, until we get there, I think it's important we have to continue to have, you know, a system of accountability and standards that are our existing standards and assessments that are out there. I think the important thing is there's a lot, as you've heard, a lot of work going on here to think about a next generation. I think the key question here is, when do we ask folks working in the trenches day in and day out in the classroom to make that switch fully into this next generation? And certainly from the federal perspective, I think the question is, how do you stage this policy working with Congress in a manner that implements it fully and provides the room that's needed and really attends to some of the capacity concerns at the state and local level. So those are all issues that we're continuing to wrestle with. I don't think there's a very quick or easy answer to this, but I think it's going to be a major focus of reauthorization. It's going to be something we're going to be really interested in working with Congress on very closely.
And I think there's an election coming up, too. So
there is next Tuesday. Yes.
Sometimes in this town that intrudes on things. But yeah.
Barb, good question. And just two observations related to that. One is when states adopt themselves new standards, there's about a two-year lag anyway before the assessments catch up. So it's important to remind folks in the field of that situation. And it's also, I think, important to recognize that different states are going to be in different places with regard to this transition. I was recently at a meeting of colleagues from other states, and we went around the table with that. And if for no other reason than because of where they are in their testing contract expiring, there are some states have a new procurements on the street right now. And so they'll be able to change much more quickly than states that are kind of locked into existing situations. So I guess also important to have folks recognize that just because the state across the river is doing things one way and their state is not, it's not because they work with a bunch of dunderheads in their state. You know, there are just different nuances going on. But 2 years and 4 years is a big difference, and I think that's part of what this supplemental funding is for that Chris mentioned, is to help with that transition. So thank you.
We have time for one more question.
Jerome Dances. I'm a retired math professor from the University of Maryland. Remedial mathematics in college means arithmetic and high school algebra 1, 1980s style. So the Common Core standards, well, also have these plus math standards for students who are going to go on, who wish to be, have STEM majors, and I didn't hear any mention as to whether they were going to be part of the assessments. The question that I sort of have is related to focusing. Colleges actually do not expect students to show up knowing any statistics. In fact, we would actually might prefer that they didn't. And if you would marginalize the statistics part, it would provide greater focus. But certainly, having students learn a lot of statistics is not going to reduce the number taking remedial math when they get to college.
Well, you're right. The number of standards in the high school mathematics document is a little bit overwhelming. And if we are charged, as we have been charged, with providing accurate measurement of where students stands against every standard and using a rule of thumb of about 6 independent observations, 6 multiple choice items, for lack of a better term, for every standard, I don't know when students would have time to learn the standards because we'd be testing them all the time. So there really is a problem with the breadth of the shoreline on the high school math standards and trying to build a comprehensive assessment system that would cover all that territory. For the Smarter Balance perspective, the STEM standards, the ones with the pluses, are getting much less focus than the non-STEM standards, although there is statistics and other, say, non-traditional Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2, Trig kinds of standards included. But the STEM standards are pretty much supplemental, as you will, from the core assessment system. And both the consortia are required to have and did include in their applications significant participation with higher institutions of higher ed. I think Park had something like 95% of the students who will move forward to post-secondary education are represented by higher education institutions that signed on to partner with you all. I think about 75% for Smarter Balanced. And that is that is associated with where the high school standards will be established to represent this readiness to move into post-secondary. And since that was the last question, the other thing that hasn't been mentioned is that I know that NAEP is engaged in also it's not a readiness standard, but it's a preparedness study with regard to what's going on with regard to 12th graders being prepared for post-secondary. And that study, I think, is scheduled to be released in about the 2014 timeframe as well. So a lot of constellations will start coming together at the same time around this 2013, 14, 15 timeframe to better understand the bridge between secondary and post-secondary.
Craig?
I just want to reemphasize perhaps one thing that relates to that notion. Joe and I think we at least used to be friends. something he said today I thought was
we'll now see.
I think he said something like, you know, the standard is that they want to enter college ready means you can enter a credit-bearing college course without remediation. I think he said that's a pretty clear standard. I would say that that's a very unclear standard, and I would really encourage both consortia to really buckle down on what it means to be college ready. I mean, what college? What course? What instructor? Where? You know, I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, this notion of college readiness is such a global thing. I mean, that the notion of entering without remediation is it sort of narrows it slightly, but in terms of a measurement perspective, to make a confident inference about what that score means, I think you've got to narrow that down a lot further. And I've only spoken about college ready. Career ready is like a morass that I don't even want to get near. So I say God bless the people who have to do that validation effort. But I'll encourage you to try.
And we'll end by being blessed. Thank you to the panel. And thank you all for coming.